Chapter 6, The Yoga of Meditation. The Holy Lord said, he who performs bounden duty without desiring action's fruit, he is a renouncer yogi, not he without fire or action. Know that to be karma yoga, which also is called renouncement, none becomes a karma yogi without renouncing inner deeds. Desiring to attain yoga, the wise use action as the means. For him who has attained yoga, tranquility becomes the means. When he is attached neither to the sense objects nor to actions, and has renounced all purposing, he's said to have attained yoga. He should lift himself by the self, he should never degrade himself. The self is indeed the self's friend and the self's only enemy. For him who has conquered himself by the self is a friend. But for him who has not conquered himself, the self remains a foe. The highest self of him who has conquered himself and is peaceful is steadfast in cold heat, pleasure, pain, and honor and dishonor. The yogi who is content in knowledge and discrimination, with senses conquered unto him, earth, stone, and gold are all the same. He attains eminence who looks the same on well-wishers, friends, foes, neutral to enemies and kin, the righteous and the unrighteous. Constantly concentrating on the self, the yogi should remain alone with thought and self-controlled, without desires or possessions, establishing for himself in a clean place, not too high or low, covered with a cloth and with an antelope skin and kusha grass. With mind one-pointed, thought-controlled, senses subdued, let him sit there on that seat and practice yoga for his self-purification. Holding his body, head and neck, erect, motionless and steady, looking toward the tip of his nose steadfastly, not looking around. With mind quieted, fear banished, firm in the brahmachari's vow, with mind controlled, thoughts fixed on me, he should sit devoted to me. Always disciplining himself, the yogi whose mind is subdued goes to nirvana, supreme peace, and attains to union with me. Yoga is not eating too much, nor is it not eating at all, not the habit of too much sleep, nor keeping awake, Arjuna. For the moderate in eating and in diversion disciplined, moderate in sleep and walking, yoga destroys all his sorrow. When he is absorbed in the self, alone and with his mind controlled, free from longing, from all desires, then he is known to be steadfast. As a lamp in a windless place flickers not, to such is compared the yogi, with his mind controlled, steadfast in yoga of the self. When the mind comes to rest, restrained by the practicing of yoga, beholding the self by the self, he is satisfied in the self. When he feels that infinite bliss through his purified intellect, which transcends the senses and set in his true state, he is steadfast. Having obtained this, he regards no other gain better than that, and established therein, he is not moved by heaviest sorrow. Let that which is called yoga be known as the state of severance from pain, and which should be practiced with perseverance undisturbed. Abandoning willful desires, all of them without exception, also completely restraining the many senses by the mind. With intellect set in patience, with the mind fastened on the self, he gains quietude by degrees. Let him not think of anything. Whenever the unsteady mind, moving here and there, wanders off, he should subdue and hold it back, directed to the self-control. The yogi whose mind is tranquil, with passions calmed, free of evil, having become one with Brahman, attains the supreme happiness. Thus constantly disciplining himself and freed from all evil, easily contacting Brahman, he attains boundless happiness. He, disciplined by yoga, sees the self present in all beings, and all beings within the self, he sees the same self at all times. The one who sees me everywhere, and who sees all things within me, I am never lost unto him, nor is he ever lost to me. He, established in unity, worships me, dwelling in all things. Whatever be his mode of life, that yogi ever abides in me. He who judges pleasure or pain by the same standard everywhere that he applies unto himself, that yogi is deemed the highest. Arjuna said, this yoga which is taught by you, characterized by evenness, I do not see how it endures, owing to the mind's restlessness. The mind is restless, turbulent, strong and unyielding, O Krishna. I deem it as hard to control, as hard as to control the wind. The Holy Lord said, without doubt the mind is restless and is difficult to control, but through practice and dispassion it may be governed, Kunti's son. Yoga is hard to be attained by one whose self is uncontrolled, but that one who is self-controlled, striving by right means, attains it. Arjuna said, possessed of faith but uncontrolled, with mind wandering from yoga, what is the end of him who fails to gain perfection in yoga? Does he not, fallen from both, then perish, supportless, a torn cloud? O mighty arm, deluded in the path that leads unto Brahman. This doubt of mine, O Keshava, you should now completely dispel. It is not possible for aught but you to dispel this my doubt. The Holy Lord said, verily, O son of Pritika, there is no destruction for him, neither here nor hereafter, for doers of good never come to grief. He gains the worlds of the righteous and dwells there throughout countless years. Then the fallen yogi takes birth among the pure and prosperous, or else he will be born into a family of wise yogis. Verily, a birth such as that is hard to obtain in this world. There he regains the knowledge which he acquired in his former life, and strives even more than before for perfection, O Kuru's son. His previous practice alone impels him on the yogic path. He who just asks about yoga rises above the Vedic rites. That yogi, striving earnestly, pure from taint, gradually gains perfection throughout many births, and thus reaches the highest goal. The yogi is regarded as superior to ascetics and jnanis, or doers of works. Then be a yogi, Arjuna. Of all the yogis, he who with the inner self merged into me, with faith devoted unto me, I deem him as the most steadfast. Om Tat Sat. Thus in the Upanishads of the glorious Bhagavad Gita, the science of the eternal, the scripture of yoga, the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna, ends the sixth discourse entitled, The Yoga of Meditation.
Good evening, good afternoon, good morning to those of you in Australia and other parts of the known world where it is tomorrow. And since those of you who are listening to Kamuda's beautiful singing will remember that one of the very last lines in Chapter 6, where we're going to end up today, is, therefore, Arjuna, be a yogi, be a yogin. The yogin is superior to the ascetic, to the one who does austerities. He's superior to the learned, and the yogin is superior to those who perform action. Ritual action is what he's talking about. Therefore, be a yogin, Arjuna. And of all those yogins, one who has merged his inner self in me, honors me, full of faith, is thought to be the best. So be a yogin, all of us. It's a beautiful, honorable recognition of what it is that every one of you has in some measure dedicated your life to. We are all yogins, practitioners of yoga in whatever form we practice. So welcome to our third class. After a week in which I know many of you have been forging your own approach to karma yoga, to the yoga of offering, and to the powerful experience of contemplating your life, which the Bhagavad Gita creates for us so powerfully. I was very moved reading today Gita's experience of recognizing Krishna as her own body, as her own consciousness. I've actually been very moved by many, many of the sharings that have come in on the listserv, and I know that there are many others who are not sharing, who are just quietly going about your lives during your practice and perhaps reading what others are saying. But the truth is that all of us here are being affected, even if we feel that this week and this month is so busy that we are not able to do the practice in the way that we might have wanted to. Nonetheless, we're all being affected. We're all being, in a certain sense, carried by this. One of the very beautiful, subtle truths that Krishna offers us in Chapter 4 is that as we practice, as we make offerings with the understanding that what we're offering to is our own self, and that the one who makes the offering is our own self, and that our self is identical with the highest, with the absolute. You know, this is over and over again Krishna's teaching. One of the things that he promises us is that even if we start out not having a clue as to what the self is, as to who God is, by doing this practice, by joining our consciousness with whatever we are able to understand as being its source, by doing this, practicing it again and again, we start to be guided, we start to be led, we start to recognize the truth that we're aspiring for, that we're aspiring to. My guru used to say, meditation teaches you meditation. And when I first heard him say this, it was really back in the day when I was, you know, one of the more clueless yogis of my cohort. I was a pretty good practitioner, but I really was not sure in those days what it meant to be really immersed in meditation. And as I'm going to explain in the course of this class, it actually took me a long time to experience what I would call deep meditation. Really quite a long time, longer than many of you, which is perhaps one reason why I'm able to teach meditation, is because I really know all the pitfalls that can occur along the path. So when my guru said, meditation teaches you meditation, I was completely mystified. And one of the ways in which, over the years, as I practiced, I began to recognize the truth in what he taught and the truth in what the scriptures teach about meditation and about the nature of the self, is that as you practice, as you keep trying, you know, and as you keep trying skillfully with a feeling of you're doing the trying of not trying even while you're trying, one of the many beautiful koans of yoga, little by little, the knowledge starts to dawn. It starts to become apparent. You have an experience of consciousness as not just your deepest truth, but also as that which makes everything you experience accessible to you. And you start to begin to have these moments of seeing the self in others as well as in yourself. And you start to realize, oh my God, meditation does teach me meditation. Knowledge comes through practice. And this is, you know, I would say one of the great pieces of good news that Krishna gives Arjuna, or as one of the great Kashmir Shaiva sages says, and I do love this phrase, be as you are without worrying, for the goal is assured. Be as you are without worrying, for the goal is assured. So what Krishna and the sages keep telling us over and over again is just put one foot in front of another. And, of course, part of why this text and why understanding what's going on in this text is so heart-opening and mind-expanding for so many generations, and certainly for ourselves, is that what we come to see is that the dialogue in the Bhagavad Gita isn't just between this great, possibly mythical deity named Krishna and his great devotee, also possibly mythical, Arjuna. It is actually a dialogue between two poles of the soul, between the great self, the divine self, and the individual self, the great self and its reflection, which is your soul, my soul. We are actually reflections or holograms of the great self. And that's the knowledge that Krishna is offering Arjuna and that so many of you are catching glimpses of or even having, you know, deep experiences of that are infiltrating and permeating aspects of your daily life. And this whole text is irradiated with Krishna's love for Arjuna. But again, it's not ordinary love. Krishna stands in oneness. His power, his strength, is in the almost unimaginable truth that though he is in a human body, though he's acting in a human body, he nonetheless is completely without a sense of differentiation. He sees everything in himself and himself and everything else. And one of the reasons that the Bhagavad Gita has been a text that every great teacher of the tradition has felt compelled to comment on is because he is describing the experience that is the self-realization of the non-dualists. One of the verses in Yaneshwar Maharaj's great commentary on the Gita, Krishna says, O Arjuna, the love I feel for you doesn't arise from separateness. You should know that it comes from our oneness in the self. A mirror is not kept clean for its own sake, but so that a person can see himself in the mirror. Similarly, O Arjuna, in speaking to you, I am actually speaking to myself, for there is no separation between you and me. For that reason, I am telling you, who are myself, the inner mystery. And one of the things that sometimes sends chills down my spine when I read one of those statements of Krishna's is that what he's really saying, and he's saying it again and again, is that this is the way, let's, you know, that which we call God, because it's a good shorthand for that huge, vast, love-filled consciousness that is prior to physical existence. The way that sees the soul, the way Shakti, the Supreme Self, the Great Consciousness, sees us, is as the reflection of itself. You know, when two people are in love, they see themselves reflected lovingly back through the lover's eyes. So in their eyes, we're able to see ourselves and our beauty and feel love not only for that other person, but for ourselves. And, you know, one of the great answers to this question of why diversity, you know, if assuming that behind all this, there is the intention of the great consciousness, why become many when everything would have been so much simpler if there was just the experience of non-duality, obvious and apparent through the senses. It's not all this differentiation with its potential for conflict and suffering. And the answer that's given, the non-dual answer that's given, is that, first of all, it's so that the drama can go on. Speaking as someone who likes stories, I'm always very comforted by what I believe is a Jewish teaching that God loves stories. I would say that God loves stories. Otherwise, why would we be here in the midst of these dramas? And that at the same time, the separation, the feeling of separation, actually allows relationship, paradoxically enough, because the individual feels separate from others and from the absolute. Relationship is possible. We can love each other and we can love God. We can be devotees. We can participate in the exquisite drama of coming to know the self in ourselves and in second person deity and in another person because of separation. So, and the other piece that is so profound to remember is that Krishna, Shakti, the divine in whatever form or name you give it, doesn't see separation, but actually only sees the self. So when Krishna gives Arjuna the clues as to what it will take for him to live an awakened life, he's not talking to a pupil or even to a friend, he's talking to his own soul. He's reminding himself as Arjuna or himself as you and me of what we've forgotten. And in fact, from Krishna's viewpoint, the war, and that means the wars that we are living in now, is not going on outside. The delusion, the ignorance, the pain, the fear, the suffering is all going on inside his own body of consciousness, not happening to a bunch of ignorant souls down here on the earth plane, but inside his own soul. It's all going on inside God. God is experiencing it through you. And that means that he's experiencing all of it, the full catastrophe. It's not happening somewhere else. It's not that Krishna is sitting someplace in his earth, in his, you know, heaven world, eating ambrosia and drinking nectar. It's that Krishna is experiencing it all through our eyes, through our bodies. So let's begin our evening's practice by chanting. You can find the invocation on your paper. We'll chant it three times. And remember, the English goes, I salute Madhava, which means the sweet one, the name of Krishna, the source of supreme bliss, whose grace makes a dumb person eloquent and lets a cripple cross mountains. So find your posture. Make an offering of the inhalation to the heart, your own heart. make an offering of the exhalation to the great universal breath, which is the source of breath. And allow the breath to be offered into the heart on the inhalation and offered into the universe on the exhalation. Mukham karoti vachalam bhangam langayate giram yadkripatamaham vande paramananda madhavam. Mukham karoti vachalam bhangam langayate giram yadkripatamaham vande paramananda madhavam. Mukham karoti vachalam bhangam langayate giram yatkripa tamaham vande paramananda madhavam. I want to point out a couple of significant words here, Sanskrit words. One of them is kripa, meaning grace or divine help. Another is vande, or one day, which means I adore, I worship, I salute. It's a very, it's a devotional. It's the word that indicates offering devotion. Paramananda means the supreme bliss, the greatest bliss. So we offer our salutations, our devotion to that grace, that power of awakening that we call Krishna, whose nature is supreme bliss, which we will, if we're not experiencing that tonight, which we will in time experience, because that's what Krishna promises. So let's just take a moment to find the posture. If you're seated quietly in a room, on a cushion or on a chair, then take these moments to create a posture that's very firm and very stable. Feel the support of the seat and feel your buttocks and hips and thighs sinking into it. Feel the breath helping the torso rise to an erect posture, the shoulder blades release onto the back. The head and neck become not only stable but aligned. I like to use the image of the string that connects the fontanelle, the top of my head, to the ceiling. The chin just slightly lifted, tiny bit lifted. Your eyes in this practice are half closed. We're actually echoing the instructions that Krishna will give Arjuna at the end of the chapter 6. And bring your attention, your awareness right now to the breath. As you feel the breath being breathed into your body, as though you're being offered the breath by the Supreme Being who is the source of breath. And then feel your exhalation as an offering back into that Supreme Being. And we're going to take a few more minutes to once again enter the practice that we began last week. See if you can turn your attention inside so that rather than letting your attention move to the object that you're seeing, remember your eyes are half closed, you can let the sense of sight flow back until you become aware that there is something inside that's seeing through the eyes. And feel that whatever it is you're seeing is actually an offering to the power of sight, to Krishna, to Goddess, to the Paramatma, the Supreme Soul, seeing through your eyes and enjoying the object of vision. And you may feel like moving your eyes around, moving your gaze around, making the offering of other objects of vision to this one who's seeing through your eyes. And as you hear these words, turn your attention inward towards that which hears, towards that which allows hearing to take place, to that consciousness, that awareness, which is the subtle form of the divine, which is Krishna's form, which is Goddess's form. Consciousness is appearing as the power to hear and as the sounds that you hear. So it's Krishna himself, Lakshmi herself, Shakti herself, seeing through the eyes, hearing through the ears, experiencing the sensations that you feel in your body. Your body, your physical senses are the vehicles through which divine consciousness is experiencing this world, the world of your body, which is not really your body, which is actually the vehicle of Goddess's fire, of Krishna's love. And just recognize that your sensory experience, your breathing, is the offering. Your very life is an offering. And as thoughts arise, or as memories of the thing that you just completed or the thing you're just about to start arise, remember to let those two be the offering. We are doing the beautiful karma yoga of recognizing our own life, our own sensory experience, as the very act of yogic practice. This is perhaps the ultimate tantric practice, the recognition that your very life is the offering, because your very life is the life of the divine. So one of the wonderful things about the Bhagavad Gita, I always feel like when I read the Bhagavad Gita, it's sort of like sitting at the grown-ups table, because it's such a hardcore blueprint that Krishna is offering us, kind of no excuses blueprint. Here we are, it's time to put our money where our mouth is, as it were, and just recognize what it takes. What the yoga of knowledge and the yoga of action really are. And though we can't bypass this teaching, the truth is that we can hack it. You know, the Gita is a very succinct text, And part of what we do as we practice it, as we read it and practice it, is we figure out actually how to hack it. I actually love that concept of life hacking, because the Bhagavad Gita is it's a method of life hacking. And what we start to see as we look at it is that there's space in the Gita, there's space in Krishna's teachings for approaching it from pretty much wherever you happen to be. So there's a way of reading this text, and you know, which is very much the way of classical yoga, in which we pay a lot of attention to Krishna's teachings about character. And he has a lot of teachings about character. We're going to come to them even more later on in the text. You know, the insistence on how important it is to practice yama and niyama, to do the yogic do's and don'ts, to really examine our actions, to see that we're acting nonviolently, that we're telling the truth, that we're practicing contentment, that we're restraining our senses, that we're not stealing, that we're not grasping. So these yogic practices, these character practices, I call them, are one of the main themes of the Gita. But in the process of reading it, what you also start to realize is that Krishna is also saying, simultaneously saying, however you're living, you know, however skillful or unskillful you are in these yogic practices, what I mainly want you to get, O Arjuna and all of us, what I mainly want you to get is the recognition of who you are as the self and the fact that your self is in me. And the purification processes that we do, and I'm a great believer in purification, are simply to start to remove the schmutz that, you know, that is making it hard for us to self-recognize. And that schmutz includes our feelings of guilt and unworthiness and, you know, all the ways in which we recognize that we've been out of integrity with ourselves, that we need to do that work, not because it makes us good people, because what Krishna really says to Arjuna is, you know, we are already good people. We have Buddha nature. Those aren't his words, of course, but our self is always pure. So we do this character work in order to make it possible for us to see that. And part of what he's doing here, as he shows us how to make every quadrant of our lives part of yoga, is we feel kind of busted. The false egoic self feels kind of busted, because the truth is that life itself is always kind of showing us what the ego looks like when it shows up and, you know, starts to distort our experience. And the reason that this text does this is really, it's just meant to wake us up. It's like the Zen master's stick, you know, the person who goes around the hall when people are sitting for zazen. And if the body is slumping or if they're falling asleep, you'll hit them on the shoulders, sometimes rather firmly, I understand, with a flat stick. That's really meant to say, hey, pay attention, wake up. Don't go to sleep. Don't be unconscious. Don't walk through your life like people who take Ambien and then get up and read the icebox. So Krishna's going to say, give up desire and anger. He's going to say it again and again. He's going to say, you have to do that. But what he is really wanting to tell us is, Alice very elegantly said in her post today, that we're being asked to get used to letting the small self, ego, the false self, start to retire, to realize that actually the false self ego, even though it tells us constantly that we need it, it's actually not necessary. We can let go of it. And So when we're doing this inquiry, asking ourselves, you know, questions like what's my motivation or what kind of action am I really offering? Is this something that I want to offer to God? We are actually doing quite a high practice for helping the false self-ego to retire. And I also want to say again that the practice of offering our desire and anger and our jealousy and our greed and our grief and our various so-called imperfections, that the practice of offering these to the self, to Krishna, to the fire, is an utterly crucial and significant and totally allowable part of the path. And I say this because, partly because I've been reading some posts from people who say that it doesn't feel right to offer anger or grief or the feeling of unworthiness. Krishna would definitely not agree with you. In fact, one of the secrets of this particular practice of allowing Krishna's teaching to take you from wherever you are to the place of being what he calls a true yogi, is that when you're doing something that is, let's say, yogically incorrect, you offer that too. In other words, when you're in the middle of eating a carton of ice cream that you know is not going to make you fat or give you a sugar high that will keep you awake all night, or smoke a cigarette, or spend the evening watching old Springsteen concerts or reruns of South Park on YouTube, or whatever yogically incorrect activity you catch yourself in, you offer it. So you smoke a cigarette and you offer it. I'm not suggesting you smoke a cigarette, but if you happen to be smoking a cigarette, you offer it. You watch an hour of, stupid TV, and you offer it. And you watch an hour of smart TV, and you offer that. So because offering any action is going to connect you to the self, if you keep offering, what you'll notice is that the power in the self, the space of the self, and we're going to come back to this a few times tonight, is actually going to transform your tendency or your addiction or your anger. That is, when you offer, you open to having that tendency or that desire melted. And again, this is something I can tell you with utter conviction, because it has proved to be the method by which most of my addictions, knock on wood, have been pretty much let go of. And it's, kind of an extraordinary thing, as I know it is for many of you, to look back at your life and to say, oh, okay, 15 years ago, I could not keep myself from eating 5 cookies where one would do, and now I can eat a tiny little bite of a cookie and feel completely satisfied because something about that intensity of sweets craving no longer has me in its grip, even though I still enjoy cookies. So offering really works. And there's a famous story, which is kind of the essence of the Mahayana Buddhist approach and the tantric approach to melting these qualities. It's a story about a Buddhist monk who comes home to his cell to find a thief running away with his TV set. Well, no, actually, he didn't have a TV. It's a 16th century story. His begging bowl and his extra robe. So he says to the thief, why don't you sit down? And he talks to him for a while, and the thief starts to feel embarrassed, not just guilty, but embarrassed. Here he is. He's just stolen the last possessions of this wonderful person. And he says to the monk, I feel that I'm doing a wrong thing by taking these things from you, and I'm happy to give them back. I don't know how else to make a living. So the monk says, it's okay. Do what you need to do. But just whenever you go to rob a house, offer your action in the name of the Buddha. So, and it's really fine. Keep my robe and bathing bowl. So the thief goes away feeling, understood. And he begins to carry out the monk's instructions. So he'll go to break into a house and he'll offer the action and he'll take something from the house and he'll offer the action. And of course, the way the story goes is that one day, a year later, the thief comes back to the monk's cell and he says, you know, I'm just completely flabbergasted. I kept offering and offering, and then one day the Buddha appeared before me just sitting in the air, and after that I couldn't bring myself to steal anymore. So the point, of course, is that we don't have to beat ourselves up and try to become, you know, better people than we are. What we do have to do is recognize, just be conscious of our actions and offer them. And Krishna says, this is really, let's call it the ultimate life hack. When we start offering, when we start doing the yoga of offering, it actually eventually will change the way you do things in so many ways. Not only give you more of a capacity for excellence in your actions, but also a kind of common sense that you may not have had before, a capacity for seeing what's good for you and what takes you to the self. So, again, let's just sit for a moment. And as you sit, once again, bring your awareness to the breath flowing in and the exhalation being offered out. And see if you can feel in this moment that this great power that breathes you, which we can call Krishna, we can call Lakshmi, we can call Goddess, we can call consciousness, but it's surrounding you, it's filling you. And as you breathe, this great consciousness is literally breathing love into you. So as you sit with this, feel yourself take refuge, which is one of the great, great teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. So if you can let yourself take refuge in that, take refuge in Krishna, take refuge in Goddess, take refuge in consciousness. Remember that Krishna's Shakti, Krishna's feminine aspect is Lakshmi, who is the feminine force of divine abundance and golden love. So as Krishna's love is poured into you, recognize that that love is the form of Goddess, the form of Lakshmi, the form of this extraordinary power of adoration. That with every breath is infusing love into you. So take refuge. So in the class today, we're going to spend a few minutes going deeper into verse 35 from chapter 3, which is the verse on Dharma. And then we're going to speak a little bit about some of the teachings in chapters 4 and 5, and then meditate with Krishna's teaching from chapter 6. So we're moving deeper into the issue of Dharma itself. And this is the verse that was in our homework this week. Better is one's own Dharma, though in itself faulty, than an alien Dharma well done. Death in one's own Dharma is better. It is perilous to follow the Dharma of another. This is This is Aurobindo's translation, actually. There are many different translations of this verse. Better is one's own dharma, one's own duty, one's own natural action, even though in itself it's imperfect. In other words, your dharma is not as cool as somebody else's dharma, but still it's better to do yours than somebody else's. Why is it perilous? Why is it dangerous? Well, that's the question that I think we all need to ask ourselves. Why is it dangerous to do something that is not your nature? And the reason that I have discovered through trial and error is that when you're doing something that is not natural to you, your entire life becomes strained because you're having to work so hard just to accomplish something that is not natural to you. And the more we realize, the more we recognize what kind of actions, what kind of work, what kind of ways of relationship are natural to us, the more we're at ease in our lives. So, in the modern world, dharma is synonymous for most of us with our work or our job or our career. And that means when we ask, what's my dharma? What we usually mean is, what work should I be doing? Or how do I make the choice between, let's say, being with my kids and pursuing my career as a lawyer? But even though these issues are certainly an important aspect of our dharma, nonetheless, the deep meaning of dharma has not so much to do with the profession we follow or the career we follow or even the calling we follow, the avocation we follow, but as how we follow the inbuilt nature, the inbuilt laws of our nature. So in other words, your dharma is what you are. In fact, Abhinavagupta says in his commentary on this verse, he actually says it's very sweet. He says, my theory, Abhinavagupta says, is that we each have our dharma built into us, that it's essentially innate, that it's encoded in our nature. In other words, our dharma is in the DNA, possibly partially as a result of our ancestral lineage, our heritage, or as the blueprint of our soul in this lifetime. But it's not just your obligation, so they certainly have their own dharma. Your swadharma, which means your own duty or your own law, swadharma, I like to translate it as your own law. That is the law that's innate in your being. It's what you're born to do. It's where your integrity lies. And that, what that means is that what you do is actually the way you express your dharma, and the way you use your energy. So you may be a lawyer, but the way you practice law will have to do with your innate temperament, your innate intuition about where your integrity is. And of course, finding your dharma can often mean making a lot of missteps, and stepping out of the expectations of society. I mean, one interesting example for me was when during the marches this weekend, a lot of people were saying, why did Hillary Clinton go to the inauguration? And, she could have boycotted the inauguration like other people did. And, yet it was clear that for Hillary Clinton, attending the inauguration was her dharma. I have no idea what went through her mind, but I suspect that it never occurred to her not to go to the inauguration, because who she is a person who fulfills her political obligations, the obligations of her, the life she's chosen. So I know that as I started contemplating the issue of what is my dharma, and like everyone else in this world, it's an open question, and it's a question that I've had to consider over and over again in different situations, as you have. as I look back over my life and realize that I have really found my dharma by making false, making bad choices, making missteps. I mean, for example, I got married at 23 because I happened to have fallen in love with a suitable person at a time when everyone I knew was getting married. So I did it. I got married. And even though, I had a lot of affection for the person I married, it was always completely clear to me from the beginning that this was not what I was supposed to be doing. I did it anyway, literally stepping into the dharma of another. And then 4 years later, finally managed to step out of that and to begin to follow what I had begun to understand was a dharma that was not going to take me on the path that my contemporaries were following. In other words, that I was not going to continue a career as a journalist. I was going to become a spiritual seeker. I was going to end up spending 30 years in an ashram and then leaving the ashram because my dharma was not to be attached to an institution but to live in a different way. And every time I've tried to connect myself over a period of time with an institution that requires me to live according to someone else's dharma, it has turned out to be a disaster, even though I've learned a lot. So what I've come to see is that often we don't really see the threads of our dharma until we look back and see how we've been led, how we've been carried on the path. And one of the other things that we start to realize is that the more inner work we do, the more yoga we practice, the more our dharma changes. In other words, and I will say this in a slightly different way, when we haven't done a lot of inner work, we haven't done a lot of yoga, we're much more able to let's say, forgive ourselves for being angry or self-righteous. It's much easier for us to justify ourselves in losing our temper, or cheating in some way, or being self-righteous about other people. We all have our own versions of what I would call a dharmic action. But the more inner work we do, the more sensitive we become to the ways in which we are stepping outside our dharma. And, on every level, whether the work we're doing or the actions that we're doing or the way we're conducting our relationships is in line with the inner law of our being or not. And in the same way, we become much more sensitive to our own unkindness or to our tone of voice or to the tendencies to judge ourselves or other people. So the more inner work we do and the longer our lives, the more our lives are dedicated to yoga, the more the demands of our dharma, the insights about our dharma become subtler and subtler. So, it's at this point that we start to recognize how incredibly skillful and perfect this teaching is, better your own dharma, well performed, better your own dharma, badly performed than the dharma of another, well executed. And we start to be able to tell the difference between the discomfort that you feel when you're learning a new skill, for example, or including, of course, the skills of yoga, the discomfort that you feel when you're stepping out of your habitual patterns, which is the discomfort of growth, and which often means working with your sense of unworthiness or talking back to the voices that tell you to quit. But there's another kind of discomfort, where you just feel that what you're doing is wrong, and I'm going to give you a very out out their example, which was something I heard from a woman I know she's a famous actress, actually. And she spent years, she's black, and she, you know, like many black actresses, had a very hard time finding roles that were up to her skill. She was extremely talented. And she was working as an understudy in a Broadway show. This is years ago. And she suddenly had a realization. My dharma is not to be an understudy. My dharma is to be the lead. I'm supposed to be the lead. You know, I'm not a subordinate player. I'm a big player. Some of us have the opposite realization. You know, I've been trying to be the lead, but actually I'm much more comfortable in a smaller role. But however the recognition is, the discomfort that we feel when we're not in our proper dharma is, you know, something that we become very sensitive to. When I was first with my teacher, I had a job in Aseva to do PR for him, and to, because I had been a journalist, I had connections in the journalistic world. It seemed like a good thing, and it was nice for me because it, you know, it gave me the opportunity to interact personally with my teacher. But in actual fact, it was, you know, a terrible choice for me because I'm tremendously introverted. And even though I like people, schmoozing all day long with strangers is not something that's very natural to me. So I was very relieved when that phase of my life ended and I realized that I could just relax into my natural being and be a writer and editor and teacher. But yet I would never have had those recognitions about myself if I hadn't tried to do something that wasn't my dharma. So in that sense, even the mistakes we make are useful. Of course, the secondary meaning of the, you know, the other meaning of dharma, which is righteous action, is just as germane to yogic experience. And what I want to say is that when you're in the wrong dharma as a lifestyle, that is, you know, if you're doing the tasks that are not natural to you, it's going to be much harder for you to follow dharma in the internal sense. And, you know, one very good example of this is somebody who's not cut out to be a parent, but who nonetheless has children. And I think many of you here might have had parents who actually were not cut out to be parents. It's much harder for such a person to provide a really loving environment for their kids, even though they may do all the right things. So in understanding what the right thing to do is, one thing that Krishna says, not in the Gita, but in another text, which is called the Uddhava Gita, which is a conversation with another one of his pupils, his students, his friends. Krishna says he is intentionally not given strict rules for following dharma. He's left it vague because he says that one of the most important things for a human being to learn to do is to discern your dharma in a given moment. And that's really, really important. In other words, yes, there's a blueprint, a playbook, but it's not that there are a series of rules that you can follow which will end up taking you to liberation or even to success in being a good person. Because our lives are filled with dharma decisions that we have to make from a place of very deep connection. So, and these are questions like, do I speak up about something that's wrong? Or is it better to be quiet because somebody else might be the right person to speak up? Or do you get married even though you have a funny feeling this isn't the right thing for you? Do you let your kids play video games? Do you go along with a work culture that makes you uncomfortable because you're afraid to lose your job? Or do you do something? I mean, there are so many decisions that we make every day. Do I take time for meditation even though I have a report due in 2 hours? These are Dharma decisions. And in a certain sense, in order to make those decisions accurately, we actually need to remember the basic guidelines about Dharma, which I actually sent you in the homework last week. What are the criteria that you can use to know your Dharma? Well, one of the criteria for understanding your Dharma is, what do wise people do? What do the texts of yoga tell us? What is your own inclination? But over and above all that, what is going to take you more deeply? Into the realization of the self by means of yoga. So the texts have given us criteria for discerning your Dharma, even though they haven't told you what to do in every circumstance. And therefore, one of the gifts that we get from practicing Krishna's teachings is to, you know, to actually begin to ask ourselves that question: what's the next right thing, or what would love do now? What's Dharma for me in this moment? So again, you can close your eyes. Bring your attention to the breath. So you're offering the exhalation into the universal breath and receiving the inhalation. You're feeling the sensations in your body. Some pleasant, some uncomfortable. You're sensing all the little aspects of your experience, the moisture in your mouth, the slight feeling of the tickle of your clothes against your skin, the sounds you're hearing, whatever you're seeing with your eyes open. And your intention now is to let go and recognize all that I'm experiencing through my senses, everything that's going on inside my mind. It's all happening inside this one great consciousness that is Krishna, that is the divine. It is Brahman. So my seeing, my hearing, my tasting, my smelling, and everything I see and hear and taste and smell is naturally being offered to that great consciousness, which is experiencing life through my body mind. So in these chapters, the chapters that we've been studying, chapters 2, 3, 4, Krishna has been talking over and over again about the yoga of knowledge, the yoga of renunciation, and the yoga of action. And especially, he's been talking about the yoga of action, karma yoga, and the yoga of knowledge, jnana yoga. One of the things he says again and again is that the two, Karma Yoga, the yoga of action, and Jnana Yoga are inseparable. In other words, that you can't practice Karma Yoga skillfully unless you're really aware that, or at least have the intention to be aware, have the remembrance that the object of your action, the goal of your action, and the source of your action is actually the self, is actually the divine, is actually God. So, and, you know, so one of the very important points that he makes is that Jnana Yoga, the yoga of knowledge, does not mean scholarly knowledge. It's not the kind of knowledge we can acquire. It actually comes about by a kind of deconstruction process where we look into our bodies and our thoughts and everything else, and we disentangle our sense of who we are, of who I am, from identifying with those aspects of ourselves. As Krishna says in chapter 6, the blindness of the ego is in identifying itself with the body and the mind. And to really start to see the consciousness, the self-sense, the sacred essence that is present to everything that we're experiencing and thinking, but is able to stand apart from it. So knowledge is the ability to recognize consciousness, awareness, love as the actor. And at the same time, Krishna points out that in order to hold this knowledge, you have to practice, you have to do yoga. And essentially, you have to do yoga with the attitude that your goal is not success in the actions, your goal is liberation. Your goal is really recognizing the truth about yourself. And one of the really deep teachings that Krishna gives in discussing this is in book 5, in verse 22. He talks about the true yogi as being one who can bear the velocity of desire and anger. You know, Krishna is going to say again and again, evenness of mind is yoga. He's going to turn us towards balance. But he does say, get rid of desire and anger. But the more skillful life hack that he's offering us here in this verse is pointing to our ability to actually stay present with desire and anger. In other words, to not be freaked out when anger and desire come up. So, and to me, this is a tremendously sophisticated teaching. But it's also very, very significant as an approach to dealing with our own emotions. You know, for some of us, anger and desire come up because we see something beautiful and we want it, and we're angry because we can't have it, or we feel the injustice of other people's lives, or, you know, we simply experience guilt and self-doubt and get angry at ourselves for having those feelings. So Krishna's point is that the paradox here is that we don't dissolve desire and anger by repressing them or suppressing them. We dissolve as, and, you know, if you think that you know this, think of all the times you've ever tried to pretend you didn't want something or damp down your anger because it's inappropriate. So The way we dissolve desire and anger is to constantly turn our attention to the space beyond them, to that place which is untouched by anger and desire, and that place where, as Krishna says, desires enter me as rivers enter the ocean, which I think is a very, very beautiful way of explaining this process. Desires enter me. Desires enter me like rivers entering the ocean. So the method for working with all of the obstructions of yoga, and it's the method that Krishna gives over and over and over again, is to turn your attention to the self in whatever form you can touch it. Maybe you become the witness and stand aside from it. Maybe you can do one of the practices where you actually breathe space into the pores of your body, because the experience of spaciousness is one of the great, not just metaphors, but methods for experiencing the self. Or you turn your attention to the mantra or to the sense of Krishna or goddess behind you, bringing your attention back to the sense of this divine presence into which you can offer your emotions, or to do the tantric practice from the Vijnana Bhairava, where you turn deeply into the actual felt experience of intense desire or anger, and feel the Shakti at the core of them. That's an advanced practice, but it's very, very powerful. At the beginning of chapter 5, Arjuna asks Krishna one of the big confusing questions, you know, and he says, okay, you've been talking about renouncing actions, even renouncing anger and desire, even renouncing sense pleasures, because he talks about that a lot, and yet you say that the best path is to perform your actions as offerings, you know, as yoga. So Krishna says, well, they both lead to the same effect. If you give up the world for the sake of the truth and you practice your actions for the sake of the truth, both of those methods are going to take you to the truth. But he says, the way they're going to do this is when you stop identifying yourself as a limited being. In other words, what you are supposed to renounce, whatever you're doing, is not the actions, it's not even the pleasures, it's this idea of yourself as the egoic self. There's a story I want to tell you about renunciation. It's one of my Guru's favorite stories, and it comes from the Yoga Vashishta, which is a great, great text of Vedanta, and really, you know, maybe the most take no prisoners text there is about what it actually means to recognize that everything is consciousness. And this story is about a king named Shikidwaja who's married to a queen whose name is Chudala. And Chudala is an enlightened yogini. She's in the state that Krishna talks about when she's completely poised in the self. She has no identification whatsoever with her body, and she's a queen, but her actions as a queen are just being performed with the awareness that she's not the doer. Her husband, on the other hand, Shikidwaja, is completely involved in his role as king and having a terrible time. He's suffering from frustration. He feels like he never has any peace. He's incredibly unhappy. And one day, a sage comes to the palace and gives a lecture on the Bhagavad Gita, and he teaches one of Krishna's great teachings, which is peace follows renunciation. So the king says, okay, I'm going to renounce my kingdom. You know, he has the typical misunderstanding that people have when they hear about renunciation. And the queen tries to dissuade him, but he'll hear none of it. So he gives up his kingdom. He goes to the forest. He builds himself a little hut out of logs and bark, and he begins to meditate. And he has nothing there except, you know, he's eating roots and berries. He's wearing, you know, animal skins. He has a little fire. He's trying to practice. And he's just getting more and more agitated and upset because, of course, he's not used to this lifestyle. So it's, you know, it's aside from his normal mental issues, he's now got all this discomfort to deal with. So one day the queen, who's omniscient, you know, sees that he's very unhappy and that he's beginning to be ripe to hear the truth. So she creates for herself a body as a young sage named Kumbha and goes out to the forest and, you know, says to her husband, "So how are you doing, King?" And he says, "Ugh," King says, "Ugh, God, I'm so unhappy. I'm just, nothing is working. I'm no good at meditation. I'm cold. I'm hungry. I'm miserable." And the young sage, who's really the queen, says, "Oh, Your Majesty, peace follows renunciation." And then he disappears. So the king decides he'll give up more. He'll give up his clothes. He'll go naked. And, you know, he goes on. The sage, the young sage, who's really the queen, keeps appearing and checking up on him and then giving him this mysterious teaching. And finally the king says, "Okay, nothing works. I guess I'm supposed to give up my body." So he builds up his fire. He circles the fire. He's about to offer his body into the fire when suddenly the sage Kumbha, who is his wife in disguise, comes, grabs him by the arm, pulls him away, and says, "King, what is the matter with you? You're renouncing things that don't belong to you. You know, your clothing doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the trees that you took it from. The hut doesn't belong to you. It's, you know, it's something that was constructed and someday it'll go away. Your body doesn't even belong to you. It's the product of your parents', you know, ovum and sperm, and it's made of the food that you've eaten. None of this belongs to you. What you should renounce is the only thing that you're grasping, which is your egoic false self, your identification with all these things. Give that up, King. That's the true renunciation." And the story goes that the king, you know, who's done this intense austerities, gets it, and he sits down and he goes deep into meditation, deep into samadhi. When he comes out, he sees the queen in front of him, and she explains to him that she's orchestrated the whole thing to wake him up. And then they go back to the kingdom, and they rule for 100 years in a state of complete non-duality. And the story goes that even the parrots in their trees say, "Shivoham, I am God." So, as Krishna says, it's not about renouncing anything except your identification. And he then says, and I found this tremendously important, he says in verses 36, 37, and 38 of book 4, that even a little bit of this wisdom, even a little bit of knowledge, even a moment of recognizing that who you are is consciousness, destroys an entire backpack of what Arjuna has been calling sins. You know, all the mistakes you've ever made, including the really, really bad ones, are dissolved in the fire of knowledge. Krishna actually says, even if you are the worst sinner ever, your mistakes will be dissolved in the moment that you recognize that you are that you are the truth. Abhinavagupta, in his beautiful teachings in the Bhagavad Gita, says that liberation, the experience of liberation, is not like getting something or gaining something. It's like putting down a burden that you've been carrying for a long time. So the burden that we put down when we really let ourselves recognize the self is the backpack of the karmas that we've been holding on to by identifying ourselves as the individual. I can remember actually a very distinct moment when I realized that my practices had actually dissolved these karmas. And as I consistently have told you, it was after I'd been practicing for quite a while. I think I had been practicing for 15 or 20 years at the time. There was just this moment when I saw that the feelings of not being a good person, the feelings of unworthiness, insecurity, the sense of impurity that I had carried most of my life, you know, perhaps deep in my soul from the, you know, because it's in the DNA of Western culture that somehow we as human beings suffer from original sin. I do think that many of us in this culture carry that even if we are not, you know, even if we were not brought up with those teachings. That is such a powerful story in the Western psyche. But in that moment, I realized that somehow my psyche had been purified. And my own experience of meditation and what I know is the truth for many of you is that this happens through the process of karma yoga, offering our actions, trying to be as selfless as possible in our actions, but offering even our selfishness when that comes up, and meditating in such a way that we, our top priority in meditation is to slip into the self, to have a glimpse of the self, whether it's the feeling of having fallen into the inner path of the Sushumna or being the witness of our thoughts, or just being able to see thoughts rising and falling in the screen of the mind. Whatever gives you a moment of touching into consciousness, or, you know, complete direct path experience of just turning past the mind and becoming aware of that which knows the mind. These are the moments, the experiences that are actually liberating your consciousness. And, of course, we do this every time we do a cognitive shifting exercise, like offering your emotions or substituting a positive thought for a negative one, or asking yourself, is this fear real? But also remembering that, as Krishna has promised Arjuna, even when it seems like we're not making any progress at all, progress is being made. Krishna says in verse 39 of this chapter, one who possesses faith, the Sanskrit word is shraddha, who controls his sense organs, who is intent on it, on the practice, attains knowledge. And when he talks about controlling his sense organs, I want you to know what he is talking about is our ability to sit in meditation and turn inside. He's saying that if we just keep doing that for a certain amount of time every day, with faith that sooner or later we're going to experience the results, and of course we do experience the results in the course of our day, because as you know, regular daily meditation makes the whole day better, even if we're not having deep experiences of the self. But that faith that Krishna is talking about is not the kind of blind faith in something that we haven't experienced. It's more like the faith we learn as children when we discover that the floor will hold us, that our legs will carry us. If we keep crawling, we'll eventually be able to walk. You know, stay where you are without worrying, for the goal is assured, the text says. One who walks this path eventually gets to the destination. It's enough just to walk the path. That said, and it is one of the reasons why studying the text of, like, the Gita is so important, as we walk the path, it is tremendously important to be constantly reminded of the truth, which is why studying a text like the Gita is so radical for us, why so many of you are feeling inspired. It's said that the sources of faith, you know, the kind of working faith that is really going to help us on the path, are three. First, the texts of the great tradition, which the Bhagavad Gita is one. Second, the instructions of the teachers of our lineage. And third, our own direct experience. So the teachings are really important. The texts are really important. However, the texts have to be texts that my guru used to call post-revelation. And Krishna says it also. There are two kinds of spiritual books. There are one the kind that is written by people who are partly along the path, who haven't been anchored in the truth. The other kind is the writings of the great beings who actually have realized the truth. And, you know, the texts of Kashmir Shaivism are like that. The Bhagavad Gita is like that. The writings of Ramana Maharshi, Ramakrishna, are like that. They're texts that rigorously point to the truth. So, one of the reasons that it's so important to actually have the teachings is because if you don't have a way of adjudicating your experience, if you don't understand what the sages say about your experience, you often can mistake what's happening to you for, let's say, you know, a bigger revelation than it is, or you can think that a revelation is actually, you know, not actually a revelation, but a sign of, let's say, psychotic. And I'm thinking of a particular experience of a book that I read many years ago, which I actually recommend. It's a pretty interesting book called Collision with the Infinite. And the story is about a woman. She's a former TM student, so she'd been meditating for a while. She was married and pregnant, waiting for a bus in Paris, when suddenly she lost all sense of being a separate self. She became completely detached from her own personal self. In other words, she got on the bus, she cooked supper for her husband, but without any sense that she existed. It was like the body was doing it. This tongue was speaking, the mind was thinking, but there was no self there. And unfortunately, she didn't have any satsang, and the spiritual teachings that she had received, she had somehow interpreted as meaning that the experience of losing the ego is supposed to be accompanied by bliss. So since she wasn't experiencing bliss, she figured she was having some kind of psychotic break, or she was having a depersonalization experience. And it took her years before she actually met a teacher who explained to her what was happening and who said to her, you know, the experience of no self is completely real, but because your mind hasn't been purified of fear, you know, you're not able to fully enjoy the fruits of this awakening that's occurred to you. And it seems that once she had realized that her sadhana actually became quite powerful and profound. But one of the things she said that I never forgot was that during all these years, she lived her life, she raised her child, she got a PhD, she worked as a psychotherapist, she functioned perfectly without a sense of self. So her story is both an example of why it's okay to stop thinking that you're the doer of your actions, because your actions, as Krishna says, are going to happen anyway. But two, why we need the teachings of the truth. why we need to know that what we're experiencing is backed up by sages, is held by sages. So once again, let's close our eyes. Feel the breath. Feel the breath being breathed into your body by the Great Self. Feel the exhalation offering back to the Great Self. And as you sit with the breath, as you allow yourself to feel held by the breath, consider one of the indications that you may have experienced over the last few days of desire and anger. Desire not in the sense of what the texts call a wholesome desire, that is the natural desire, that is the desire to eat or drink because our body needs it, the desire to fulfill our obligations, the creative desire that comes up that you know helps us find meaning in life, that helps us act skillfully and beautifully, the desire to know the truth, the desire to connect to somebody that we have affection for, to experience love. Not talking so much about those desires as the desires that actually feel like they're taking you away from your dharma or from the self. So just consider what such a desire was. You know, for me, very often one of my big tests is when I'm on a plane and I have to make a tight connection, and I'm sitting, say, in the middle or the back of the plane, and the moment comes when the flight has landed and everyone gets off and surges into the aisle in order to get off the plane. And there I am with my tight connection, stuck in the middle of this row of people. And I know it's going to be, you know, 15 minutes before I get out. And, oh, my God, I could miss my plane. That's where I face into the configuration of desire and anger. It's completely established in those moments. And what we learn to do, of course, is when that anxiety comes up or that anger comes up or that desire comes up in that kind of intense situation, we learn to offer it. We learn to breathe. We learn to let it go. So the breath is flowing in, and as you offer the exhalation back to the Great Self, just consider one of those moments when you felt overwhelmed by desire or frustration and offer it. So, in the time we have left, I want to introduce, just take a moment to introduce Chapter 6, the teaching of the Yoga of Meditation, which we're going to be working with, practicing this week. Krishna says in Chapter 6, one third of the way through the Gita, Krishna begins giving Arjuna the instructions about meditation. And he says, you know, we can't become stable in knowledge of the self unless we sit still and meditate. He says meditation is the established method for coming to know the self. And so in chapter 6, he gives Arjuna the basics of meditation. He begins to tell him how to do it. And the instructions that he gives him are utterly the classic instructions for meditation. He begins by saying, and this is in verse 3 of chapter 6, a person should uplift himself by means of the self, he says. The self can be your friend or your enemy. The means, he says, to accomplish this is to begin to turn the mind towards the self. That's what it means by uplifting yourself by means of the self. Otherwise, he says, your own mind, and we know this very well, is going to become our enemy. So the yoga of meditation, which is, of course, the very heart of the yogic practice that Krishna gives Arjuna, is actually connected to or based on Patanjali's 8 limbs of yoga. So Krishna is going to give Arjuna the step-by-step instructions to withdraw the mind and go into meditation. And we're going to allow Krishna to give us those instructions. We're going to meditate with Krishna's instructions. So here's what he says. This is chapter 6, verses 12 through 16. The yogin should fix a stable seat for himself in a clean place, not very high nor very low, covering it with a cloth. Then seated on that seat, having made your mind one-pointed, withdrawing the mind and senses inward, you should practice yoga for self-purification. Holding the body, head and neck upright and still, directing your gaze to the tip of the nose without looking in any direction, with the external sense organs turned within, established in the vow of celibacy, with thoughts fixed on me, the yogi should sit and concentrate his mind on me, taking me, Krishna, as the highest reality. So notice the step-by-step here. Asana, the stable posture where you can sit for a long time. And in many of the commentaries on this verse, it's said again and again, the point is to be able to sit in the posture for a long time. Because if you can sit in the posture for a long time, the whole rest of the process will happen naturally. This is actually the secret of meditation. If you want to go deep into meditation, just sit long enough, and the mind will naturally start to turn in and become quiet. The line about celibacy, which is one of the yamas in one of the yogic do's and don'ts, actually stands in for the control of senses. In other words, in order to sit for meditation, you have to actually renounce in meditation, you know, making love with your sweetheart, eating a croissant, drinking a cup of coffee. This is, you know, totally yoga 101. We can't actually sit in meditation unless we temporarily give up all sensory stimulation. And this is, you know, not always that easy at the beginning of a meditation practice, as all of us know. So we do that essential discipline of shutting out the world, so to speak, shutting out our messaging apps, shutting out the, you know, the voices on the phone. We practice pratyahara, which means deliberately turning the senses inward, which is the next stage of yoga, we practice pranayama, you know, by paying attention to the breath. By, in fact, doing that practice we just did of inhaling and then allowing the exhalation to be an offering. And through that practice, our senses naturally start to turn inside. And then we practice concentration, dharana, by fixing our mind on Krishna, on the self. And Krishna's making what I have found to be a really important point, which is that if your goal in meditation is liberation, is freedom, is to know the truth, is to turn into the self, is to find the higher knowledge, then the correct meditation practice is to soak your mind in that which stands for the self, whether it's concentration on the form of a deity, on Krishna, or focus on a mantra, which is, you know, probably the practice that for most of us is the one that most turns us towards connection to a deity. Focusing on a mantra, however, with the understanding that the mantra is not just a stray word, but that the mantra you use, it is and should be a mantra that has been recognized as a sound form of the divine. In other words, a mantra that fully carries the energy of the deity, like the seed syllables of the goddess that we chant or that we meditate on, or one of the mantras of Shiva or Krishna. Om Namah Shivaya is said to be the sound form of Shiva. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare is said to be the sound form of Krishna. So this is another case in which you actually need some understanding in order to focus. So you would practice focusing on a mantra with the understanding that the name you're focusing on is not different from the goal, is not different from the self. Or you could practice with a visualization, as one of the visualizations we do in our goddess classes. Or you could focus on consciousness itself. You could turn your awareness to the witness. So Krishna will later tell Arjuna that it's harder to do this. It's harder to meditate on consciousness itself than it is to focus on a visible or audible form of the divine. But that's not true for everybody. Some of us really go most deep in meditation by focusing on consciousness. The point is that to have the kind of experience that Krishna is offering Arjuna, which ultimately is an experience of divine love as well as awareness, it's very helpful to have a sense that the object of your meditation is the sacred self of all. And what Krishna says is that as you focus in this way, you gradually pass into a state of meditation where the underlying awareness, love, begins to emerge from behind the screen of thoughts. We gradually segue into a connection with the happiness and the peace of the self. We learn to identify our own consciousness, our own awareness, as God's consciousness. And then we begin to recognize that this consciousness is permeating everything, is soaking everything. And in this state, Krishna tells Arjuna, we experience yoga as a dissolution of union with pain. The more we can keep returning to the self, the more we can keep allowing that which underlies the body-mind to emerge, the more we become free not only of mental suffering, but also of even physical suffering. And then Krishna says to Arjuna, he who sees me everywhere and sees everything in me, I am never lost to him, nor is he lost to me. So this is, again and again, this is his teaching he comes back to again and again. Whatever you see, whatever you hear, whatever you taste, whatever you smell, whatever you think, see God in that. Recognize God in that. My guru used to say, this is the best meditation. Because once you have the intention to see the divine in everything, then even with your eyes open, even in, you know, an ordinary state, you're connected, you're one with Krishna, you're one with the divine, you're not lost to the truth. So along with turning attention to Krishna, to God, to Goddess, to the self, to consciousness and meditation, you have the intention to see whatever is going on in your meditation is an aspect of that consciousness. The thoughts, the sensations, all of it. So Arjuna is listening to him. He's hearing these beautiful passages. And he's still in doubt. In fact, he's rather discouraged because, like the rest of us, he knows that this is really hard. You know, he says, Krishna, this is another very famous sentence. Krishna, he says, the mind is so powerful. It sweeps us away. The mind is as hard as to control as the wind. And Krishna tries to encourage him. He says, it's okay. Just keep bringing the mind back to the self. Just keep turning the mind within and you'll get it. But Arjuna is still upset. And here in verse 38, he asks what I think is one of the really crucial questions. He says, well, suppose it doesn't work. You know, suppose I'm practicing and practicing and years go by and I'm just, you know, still carried away by reverie and I've still got all these self-doubts and my mind just never comes under control at all. What happens then, he says, suppose I follow this path, I follow your instructions, and I don't succeed, and then I die. You know, what happens then? Like, what's the point? So this is a huge question, actually, because, and I think it really is the undercover question that we all have. Is there really a point in doing this if we're not, you know, super good yogis? Is following this path gonna, you know, end up making us feel like we've wasted our life or wasted our time? Are we just gonna dissolve into nothingness or, you know, find ourselves in some hard place after we leave the body? What happens? And Krishna says something that is so beautiful and that I think for everyone here, for everyone in this class, he's describing the situation that you guys are basically in, whatever you think. This is who you are. Krishna says, if you're practicing sincerely for the sake of liberation, neither here on earth nor in any other world can your soul be destroyed. No one who does good goes to misfortune. And I'm going to quote from Dineshwar Maharaj, who is one of the very greatest siddhas and commentators in the Gita. This is what he says. This is his commentary. Dineshwar's commentary is actually kind of a expansion of Krishna's words. So he says, then Lord Krishna said, O Arjuna, is any goal other than liberation possible for a person who is striving for freedom? It may happen that after a while he may have to rest from his efforts, and we all know that, you know, there's just times when you don't practice. But during that delay, he may still enjoy happiness which even the gods cannot attain. In other words, even if you stop your practice for a while, the happiness that you've unleashed in yourself through yoga is still there. Yes, it's true, he says, if he had made greater progress in the practice of yoga, he would certainly have reached the awareness of his oneness with the eternal before the end of his life. Because he didn't progress rapidly enough, naturally he had to wait. But there is no doubt that he will eventually attain liberation. Stay where you are without worrying, for the goal is assured. Attaining the worlds of those who have acquired merit, having dwelt there for endless years, one who has fallen from yoga, the Sanskrit term is yoga brashta, one who has fallen from yoga, meaning that he hasn't completed his journey. One who has fallen from yoga is born again in the home of the radiant and illustrious. And Yoneshwar says, hear how wonderful this is. Such a person easily finds the blessedness that is difficult even for the gods to attain. He enjoys the wonderful but unprofitable pleasures of the higher worlds, and his mind becomes satiated with them. So in other words, he goes to one of the great astral pleasure worlds after death. This might come as a relief to you. And enjoys shape-shifting and, you know, astral pleasures until he becomes tired of it. And then here's the important part. Consequently, he's reborn in the world of mortals, but in a family which is the mother of all righteousness, and he will grow like a shoot in a prosperous field. He's reborn in a family that follows the path of righteousness, speaks the truth, and considers whatever must be done in the light of the teachings of the wise. In such a family, the texts of yoga are a living deity. The only concern is the performance of one's own proper dharma. And discrimination between good and evil is the only counselor. In such a family, whose welfare is looked after by Lakshmi herself, and prosperity is the presiding goddess, a person who falls from yoga is reborn in a family possessing great merit. Or he may be born into a family which burns the sacrificial fire of wisdom, is versed in the knowledge of the eternal. And though his outer form may appear small, the dawning of self-knowledge appears in him just as light precedes the rising of the sun. Without waiting for maturity, to attain his state, in his youth he comes to possess knowledge. So I think that many of you on this call can recognize your own experience here, because for many of you, the desire to practice yoga, the sense of life being about more than just eating and drinking and having good relationships and doing some good in the world, that there's more to life, that in a certain sense you've been carried, as Krishna says, he's carried even against his will by prior practice. He who even wishes to know of yoga goes beyond the traditional practices. And the pure knowledge that was his when he left his former life, he gets new in full measure in this life. Similarly, you know, the intellect of such a person effortlessly grasps abstruse problems, knowledge which ordinarily can be gained only with the help of the guru. The powerful senses are under the control of the mind. We don't know how this happens, but because of past practice, meditation seeks out the house of his mind. Know that such a person is a born yogi. So even in this incredibly outgoing society, where so much is there to distract us. So many of you have become drawn to the practice of yoga. So many of you are filled with insight and wisdom that doesn't actually seem to have come from any place because it's been born in you. And of course, your interest in meditation and in hatha yoga and in philosophy is allowing you to acquire even more merit in this life. So Krishna tells Arjuna, there is no way that your practice is not going to bear fruit. And this is, of course, what he's saying to all of us. So we're going to take a few minutes to practice together, and we're going to practice the method that Krishna offers Arjuna. So if you're sitting in a place where you can close your eyes, please do that. And if you're driving or walking, you could do this same practice in a somewhat less indrawn way. So really become present to the posture. Remember, of course, the secret of the posture is having the spinal column erect, elongated. Allowing the breath to flow in and out on its own, and take this moment to withdraw your senses. If you're sitting with your eyes closed, feel that your attention flows with the breath into the heart. And you can do the same thing if you have to remain with your eyes open. But I would add one more piece. If you're driving or if you're walking or even if you're sitting quietly, have the sense that whatever you're experiencing is an aspect of Krishna, is an aspect of the divine, that the self is appearing as your body, as your mind, as your breath. Whatever worries, desires, distractions, thoughts are coming up, recognize those too as aspects of Shakti, aspects of Krishna, and offer them with the exhalation into the ether of consciousness. And we're going to do a practice of fixing our mind on Krishna himself. And we're going to do it by practicing a mantra, which is one of the great classic mantras of the Vaishnava tradition, the tradition that calls God Krishna or Vishnu or Rama. It's a mantra to God in the form of Narayana, who you may remember is that form of the divine who is said to sleep on the ocean of consciousness, who dreams his dream of the world. Narayana is one of the forms of Vishnu, who's one of the forms of Krishna. And this mantra goes, Om Namo Narayanaya, Om Namo Narayanaya, Om Namo Narayanaya. I honor the great Lord in the form of Narayan. And this mantra, which we're going to practice just for now, is very old, it's very powerful, it's very much a devotional mantra, and the sounds in it, the Narayanaya sound, are in themselves intrinsically soothing to the subtle body. So as the breath flows in, have the thought, Om Namo Narayanaya, offering it into the heart. And as the breath flows out, have the same thought, Om Namo Narayanaya. Let your attention flow with the breath and the mantra. Just allow yourself to deeply and lovingly sink your consciousness into the sound form of Krishna. Every sensation is Krishna's. Every thought is a form of Krishna, a form of Shakti. The body itself is made of Krishna's consciousness. The breath is moved by his love. And the mantra, Om Namo Narayanaya, fills your body and mind with trembling particles of the great Shakti of Krishna, whose love is the form of Lakshmi herself, whose mind is the great awareness. Whose sinuous form is expressed as waves of love and consciousness flowing through this powerful set of sacred words. Om Namo Narayanaya. Om Namo Narayanaya. Om Namo Narayanaya. Like a lullaby, allow this mantra to sing you to the state of yoga nidra as it flows with the inhalation and the exhalation. Om Namo Narayanaya. And as you meditate with the mantra, feel that Krishna himself is meditating you. It's not you doing meditation. It's the great consciousness, the great self, acting through you, turning your awareness towards itself. Om Namo Narayanaya. With your attention fixed on the self, with the breath flowing through the heart, we offer our practice to that great awareness who is the source and the expression of all that is. Asking that through this offering, all beings in all worlds may experience joy, may experience peace, may experience love. Have a beautiful week. Listen to the call again when the audio comes. Namaste. So much love to all of you. Good night.